everyone. I'm Molly Wood.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to Make Me Smart. We are joined, as always, by you because, as we like to say every week about this time, none of us is as smart as all of us.
Right at about 10:31 a.m. Pacific.
I'm just saying.
Kai could give you the seconds right now from his big radio clock.
10:32 now.
This week on the podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about the news. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the news that is getting buried by the news. Yeah. But we're also going to talk about the television industry from what we're sort of calling three different altitudes. What a big potential television deal and how it could affect what you hear on a day-to-day basis might look like. We will dip in a little bit to the television industry and how it makes its money and how it plans to keep making that money despite all of the competition from, you know, the internet.
Also, a convo with Annabelle Gurwitch. She's an actor and a writer, telling us what it's like to actually have to make a living in television. The saved you a click line here is, it used to be easier to do that.
Didn't everything used to be easier?
Yes.
Didn't it all?
Back in the day.
But before we get to any of that, my God, do we need a news fix?
So here's what I think. I think actually the news fix this week is going to need a little discipline because we could go like for I don't know how long on what's going on. But I really like the thing you said as we were getting going here and you kind of snuck it in there. The news that's getting buried by the news.
Yeah. We're going to try to keep ourselves in check today by talking a little bit about the long game because sometimes, actually very, very often, and people who are policy wonks will tell you this, very often it is the boring stuff that has the biggest impact over time. And so as all of this sort of really, really loud stuff happens, it's a good time to sort of take a step back and look at the things that are happening in the background that are likely to have really long impact. I mean, that said, okay, let me just tell you a little story. I have this, I have the New Orleans revenge, right? I've got this cold. Ooh. It will not go away. Okay. There's a chance it's now walking pneumonia. I don't know. I say that because a couple times in the last 2 weeks, two times to be exact, I have taken naps during the day.
Okay, so first of all, I love how specific you are. A couple times, two times.
Well, because those two times were marked by phenomenal activity.
We have talked about it many times on this pod. You may not step away from social media for more than 15 minutes or you as a journalist lose your credential because it's, come on, man.
Yeah, that happened two times because the first nap, 1 hour into that nap, the president fired James Comey.
Yep.
And the second nap was yesterday. And 1 hour into that nap, the president apparently leaked some sort of or gave some sort of previously classified information to the Russian diplomats who were visiting his office. And so now I have determined that I will just have to go to the hospital if need be because I ain't napping anymore. Every time I do, things get real bad.
I got out of the studio yesterday after having done the show. And everybody's sitting out in a lounge area where people listen to Marketplace, and they're all shaking their heads going, oh, my God, what happened? What happened? I can't even believe this. And I'm like, what? And they said the whole Russian classified intelligence thing. So, yeah. So those are the biggies, right? So Comey.
Those are the biggies.
And then the disclosure of classified information to Russian diplomats. But there's a list of stuff that is getting buried by that news. And that's kind of unfortunate because all the stuff that's happening in any other day or week would be big league stuff. And here's just a couple.
Yeah.
The director of the census quits. And that is the census that's going to determine stuff like congressional representation and how much money states get and all of that jazz.
Gerrymandering.
Yeah, gerrymandering the whole deal. The president signed an executive order setting up a commission on election integrity to follow up on his completely not true claim that there's large-scale voter fraud in this country and appointed a guy by the name of Kris Kobach, who is a known doubter, shall we say, of election truth, is, I guess, the only way to put that. Because there is no voter fraud in this country. There is no large-scale in-person voter fraud in this country. We just have to see.
Yeah, there's none.
There's more.
Let's see. Attorney General Sessions ordered tougher drug crime prosecutions, which I feel is probably the most significant thing that happened last week, because that has impacts for generations. We know the damage that mandatory minimums have wrought. We know that there was finally some bipartisan consensus on criminal justice reform. And that is just a crushing blow to something that a lot of people agreed on. It is worth noting here that conversations about repealing the Affordable Care Act are still happening in secret with just a few senators who have no intention of holding committee meetings on that information. Oh, and by the way, the Dakota Access Pipeline, the one that's not done yet, that went forward as soon as Trump got into office, that leaked already.
No, did it really?
It had a leak.
Oh my God. So look at that. This is my news is my job and I missed this news.
And no big deal, by the way. That pipeline's only going to run two times underneath the Missouri River, which provides drinking water all the way down to Louisiana. No big.
Wow.
And so then this is just last week, and we were left with a feeling that I think can only be summed up by the following clip.
I fired him because of Russia. I thought he's investigating Russia. I don't like that. I should fire him.
And you're just admitting that.
Uh-huh.
But that's obstruction of justice.
Sure. Okay.
Wait, so did I get him? Is this all over? Oh. No, I didn't. Nothing matters. Absolutely nothing matters anymore.
That's my gift to you, Kai Rizdahl.
It's awesome. I love that clip. Saturday Night Live from last week. Alec Baldwin, of course, is Donald Trump. Michael Che as Lester Holt. And, you know, Michael Che thinks he got him. And then in his earpiece, clearly somebody says, no, nothing matters anymore.
It's Kai. So, it was Kai.
So,
Kai's
as we've said on this program many times, nothing matters.
And then, of course, this Monday, I took a nap. And I apologize to America, because by the time I woke up, President Trump had revealed highly classified information. According to sources within the Washington Post, and it is entirely probable that that's what this entire week is going to be about. It has been so far. And meanwhile, a whole new crop of stories will fall by the wayside.
So we went out yesterday on Facebook. We did our usual Monday editorial meeting on Facebook Live. And we asked y'all what stories you were worried were going to be missed because... there's so much insanity in the news world. And here's just a couple. Alex Eldridge, he said he wants to know about millennials as first-time home buyers and how that affects the housing market and economy as a whole. Numbers out today on new home starts, and they're down because millennials can't afford to buy houses. That's one.
Yep. It's because of avocado toast.
Well, okay. So there's an Australian guy who...
the one meme that rose to the top.
Let's just back up a minute. I know, right? This Australian, like, millionaire investor dude who said, you know, and some of the reasons millennials aren't buying houses is because they're out spending $19 on avocado toast. First of all, it's not $19. But second of all, come on, man.
It is if it has crab on top. It was ridiculous. It just reignited the entire avocado toast conversation to the extent that now people are worried that it really has jumped the shark because it's going to ruin the housing market.
You'll notice that we declared it having jumped the shark like a month ago.
We're so on the zeitgeist. Walter Hanna wanted to know about tax reform and why the trickle-down ideas are so prevalent on the right, which is something that we are definitely interested in exploring. In fact, we asked you in yesterday's Facebook Live video to send us information about your state and whether you have trickle-down economics in action and whether it's working or not working, because we're curious too.
Yeah. Ali Dierks, how much of the intelligence cybersecurity workforce is employed directly by the government and how much is contracted out and does it matter? I don't know the answer off the top of my head. It kind of matters, but not the most important thing in the intelligence world as of yesterday late afternoon.
That's true.
For sure.
It kind of mattered back when it was Edward Snowden, who was a contractor.
Was a contractor. Really good point. Yep. Yeah, totally right.
Spencer Claiborne says, ooh, which I love, got all excited. Ooh, I have an idea. Things like direct primary care, pay for performance, and how the market is innovating new healthcare delivery models.
Finally, Nicholas Zahn, one of the regulars on our Facebook Lives, he wrote, I know we mentioned it last week, but I want to hear more about the unifying of local news sources under a single corporation with all the must-air stories that result, which is a fortuitous inquiry because...
That was our thing. That's our thing.
I know.
This week. Because funny thing, that story, that specific story that he's talking about, which is the proposed Sinclair Tribune merger, is in fact, it broke on May 8th, a day before the president fired his FBI director. Can I just say, too, it was really inconvenient of him to fire his FBI director, like at the moment that we were releasing our awesome Rahm Emanuel interview. Like, come on,
man. I know. It's like shouting into a hurricane.
Anyway, we mentioned it briefly on May 8th when the Sinclair Broadcast Group put in a $3.9 billion bid for Tribune Media, and that includes a whole lot of local media, 42 stations, including really big ones like KTLA in Los Angeles, WGN in Chicago, and WPIX in New York, plus the Food Network and the job search website Career Builder.
Wow. I missed the Food Network bit of it.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, that's crazy. So here's the deal with this thing, right? It gives Sinclair Broadcasting, which is a very conservative leaning broadcasting group, control of television stations that can reach more than 70% of U.S. television households, which is a big deal.
That is a big deal. And there have, of course, already been stories about Sinclair's programming, like Nicholas brought up. We're going to hear a little more about this. But we all, you know, when all of the above is going on, again, looked at this as a long game conversation opportunity because media has been such an important part of this conversation. And so we called up someone that we think is very smart about this, Zeynep Tufekci. She's an associate professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's a sociotechnologist. She writes and teaches about the effects of technology on politics and society. And here's our conversation. So I know we could talk to you about roughly 1 million topics just based on your Twitter feed alone, but we want to talk to you about information flow. I saw this great thread that you wrote post kind of some of the news about the Sinclair Tribune merger, which we want to get into, but also about what is happening in local news. So in the context of that landscape, when you see this potential merger like Sinclair and Tribune, what do you see happening?
Well, it worries me even more because what little local news we have left is also becoming increasingly consolidated and coming under the control of a group that we know to be, you know, terribly ideological. And it would really consolidate the information flows. And we're seeing this online already, right? We have Facebook and Google that are chomping up so much of the ad money. And we have increasing numbers of people who get their news through those sources. And in local news, whenever I travel around the country or when I look at where I live at North Carolina, we see layoff after layoff in what's left of independent newspapers. And we're seeing it's just harder to learn what's happening in your own hometown.
How do you then adjust for the fact that there is what feels like so much news? There's a fire hose thing that is beyond my experience going on right now.
Well, that's actually exactly why we need more filters. Fire hose is an effect of filter failure. Our gatekeepers are kind of going bankrupt. And while they may not have been perfect, they did a useful function. And we don't have new institutions that have replaced them, or have we found ways to finance them. So basically, we're relying on Facebook's algorithm to rank things for us and Google's search to sort things for us. And that's not a great gatekeeping mechanism. There's a lot of issues if that's the way you're filtering the way society gets information.
But wouldn't Sinclair say, that's why we want Tribune? Don't Verizon and Yahoo say, in consolidation, there is funding, that then there's money for journalism?
In consolidation, there is funding cuts. When they say there is funding, what they mean is they're going to cut the funds that support the diverse ecology and therefore be cheaper. And that's what you do, right? You consolidate the newsrooms and you sort of have fewer people reporting stuff and you have decimation in local news. They're either being bought by a few ideological operators or people are getting laid off in large numbers. And what happens then is, you know, you need somebody to follow what's happening at the city council. You need somebody to know who the deals are going to at the local level. And if you don't do that, a lot of local stuff gets corrupted. Contracts go to relatives or, you know, and things happen that shouldn't happen. All the things that you read about in corrupt countries start happening more and more in the United States. I want local news. I don't see that being done on the cheap, and that's the problem. That's the crisis.
So what we have here is a company doing what a company is supposed to do, right? Increase its market share, buy more, get bigger, and make more money. We have a government, a Republican government, right, doing what Republican governments typically do, which is let market forces take the lead and provide a lighter regulatory hand, as we've seen with the Sinclair thing and Ajit Pai and the FCC and all of that. Where does the responsibility fall on consumers in that environment, right? Because news consumers like to hear people that they agree with.
Right. So a couple of things here. One of them is that this isn't any player. This is a very ideologically conservative player that has been known to try to influence, have its influence on elections and other politics by pushing its own particular point of view.
Sinclair, you
which
mean?
Is obviously, you know, I'm not a Sinclairist, right? It's very conservative and it has a history of pushing conservative views and campaigning almost openly against some candidates. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't be a problem in a diverse marketplace where there are a lot of choices, right? But it's a problem if they're going to be the only news source in 200 markets. And I'd like to say I'd have the same worry even if it was some other viewpoint, like having one viewpoint mm-hmm. control so mm-hmm. much of media is a problem, especially when you know it's an ideologically aggressive group that they try to impose their viewpoint on news very strongly.
So Sinclair...
So the second thing...
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So the second thing I would say is that there are a lot of markets where it makes sense for businesses to consolidate in order to kill the market, right? So I wouldn't say this is the market working with a light hand. I would say this is more like the monopoly tendencies that always creep up if you don't beat back. So there's this misunderstanding that if you just let things be, the markets work. But as you can see from, say, Facebook or Google, if you let things be, you can have an anti-market. You can have a few big companies end up killing competition to the degree there's no viable competition left anymore and there's no way to catch up because the entry is so expensive.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I think in the earlier days of what we used to call the World Wide Web and now just apparently call the Internet, the counterargument would be, well, we have the Internet. We have all of these sources of information that we can access at any time on our phone. Is the consolidation of power by Google and Facebook a problem? Is the dissemination of misinformation, you know, helping or hurting the cause of information flow?
I think it's all related. I think we're seeing once again that there are strong centralization tendencies on the internet. And there are reasons for that. It's network effects. Everybody is on Facebook, so you go on Facebook. Or, you know, Google has all the data, so it searches better, which is going to feed on itself. I mean, obviously, those companies do good products too. But what happens is once they get past the point, they almost can't be caught up. Mm-hmm. And I think information flows is a pretty significant one where we should have multiple players, many players, because unlike shoes, if all the shoes in the world are produced by one company, maybe, you know, we just don't get some interesting styles and I can live with that. But if all the local news in most of the country is controlled by a very aggressive, ideologically determined operator, that's a different problem.
Before we let you go, we want to ask you our make me smart question. This is our sort of signature question that we ask everybody who comes on the show, mm-hmm. which is...
Oh, wait, I didn't prepare.
You don't have to.
Oh, no, you don't have to prepare.
Right. It's better
it is drawn
way.
From your wealth of personal experience. What is something you thought you knew, but you were wrong about? You later found out you were wrong about.
I mean, I have a 10-mile long list.
Most of us do.
So when the internet first came, I was pretty certain that censorship would become very hard. And that was when I was, you know, many years ago, and I grew up in Turkey, right? So in the 90s. And actually, I hadn't figured out that information overload could be a form of censorship. I grew up under information restriction as the form of censorship, and it just hadn't occurred to me. Because I'd never experienced it, because I, you know, scarcity was the way to go. I ran out of books, I ran out of newspapers, I ran out of things to read or learn. I didn't realize that you could flood people with information so much that you would confuse them and that would effectively function as censorship. And that's something that I think we're seeing more of, and that's something I learned in the past, you know, few years.
So I think that's totally interesting, right? That gets back to the point you made up at the top, burying the news with the news. Now, I don't think the chaos coming out of Washington and political America is completely intentional, right? Just for the gaffe-worthiness of it. But that's what's happening. That's fundamentally what's happening.
Everyone should go follow Zeynep on Twitter, by the way, because she also is an expert in InfoSec. And so she's been tweeting a lot about the big cyber attack that's been happening, the ransomware attack. And she has a new book out, as it happens today, about Twitter. It's Twitter and Tear Gas. It's called The Power and Fragility of Networked Protest.
Let us know what you think about this topic specifically, but also about anything you hear on the pod. Write to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or website, of course, is Or the website, of course, is marketplace.org/makemesmart. Twitter is easy and fast and quick. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. She is at Molly Wood.
And we see them all. I think we need to leave that in, by the way, because you guys never get to hear Kai do that. If you want to be part of the editorial meetings that you keep hearing us talk about, I know you're at work, but it's, you know, just sneak away. They happen at 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on our Facebook pages. If you follow those pages, facebook.com/KaiRizdahl or facebook.com/Mollywood, Facebook will helpfully tell you when we're going live. We are not unaware, by the way, of the irony that this happens on Facebook, and it is a result of a conversation about network effects. Yeah, but we hope to be posting those. I think we already have posted some of those videos on our site, marketplace.org/makemesmart, for you to catch up on later.
Next up, 5 questions for Adrian Hill. Marketplace's Adrian Hill about how television networks make money. There are those in the entertainment trade who will say that this is the best week of the year. The major television networks are gathered in New York City, upfronting, unveiling, showing off their new shows to advertisers. It's called upfront.
It's called upfront. It is, in fact, a word that gets tossed around so much like many, many words, that the meaning of it gets a little lost. I have an upfront story to tell you that I believe I'll tell you in a moment.
Do you really?
Yeah.
All right. So Marketplace's Adrian Hill covers the business of entertainment. So we played a little game. 5 questions about one word. I like it. A new game. All right. Question number 1 for Adrian Hill. What the heck are the upfronts? Ready, go.
Upfronts happen every spring. They're a time of the year when the networks, the big cable channels, they come together in New York and show off at the very tip top of their game to try to convince advertisers to spend money with them, to say, hey, look, we're the flashiest, we're the coolest, we're going to be the most buzzworthy, spend ad money with us. And we're talking in the neighborhood of like $8 to $9 billion of ad spending. So really big deal if you're an advertiser. For those of us who just like to watch television, not on our radar. This is not an event for us. This is suits impressing suits.
All right, question 2. Why are they called upfronts, which we alluded to a moment ago, and not fancy glitter TV party?
The networks are showing off their fall season today, in the spring. And so they're asking advertisers to buy now, to buy the fall's programming right now in May and go ahead and make those commitments long before the content's ever on the air. So apparently that's why it's called upfront.
Question number 3, why would you buy something before you know it's any good?
So you'd buy something before you know how good it is because, look, this is a supply and demand story. Network television is still the best bang for the buck if you're an advertiser trying to reach a broad national audience. Even though ratings are down, even though we're all watching different things on different devices, we're watching YouTube and Amazon and Netflix and Hulu, we're still watching the NFL. We're still watching live programming. We're still watching shows that break out like This Is Us. This is a time of year during the upfronts when, as an advertiser, you place those bets knowing that there's limited supply of this sort of broad reach advertising space.
Question 4, though, why would you buy TV at all when you, as an advertiser, could be getting bajillions and bajillions of YouTube or Facebook views?
I think there are a couple of reasons an advertiser would still go to television instead of going online. And here are a few of them. One is we've seen this year issues with YouTube content, with the ads that run before it, and advertisers deciding they want to make sure their ads are running in front of content they deem to be safe and brand appropriate. And that's the kind of promise a lot of internet content, especially on places like YouTube, just can't make right now. I mean, another thing is that with a live event, especially football right now, people watch that in real time. You can't make that up. You can't. If you miss the game, if you miss the play, you've missed it. You're going to hear about it later. It's not going to be the same experience. And I think that the draw of live television, especially through sports events, is still really, really significant.
My mother-in-law, for what it's worth, will not watch live sports. She's a huge sports fan, will only watch tape delayed after she knows the results. It's the most infuriating thing, because then she comes over and she's like, did you see the result of the game? And I'm like, no, no. All right, anyway. Finally, last question is from you, the listener to this pod. Tim Bartlett wrote and said, what is the future of broadcast and cable television networks? Will they exist in 5 years?
All right, to Tim, I will say, I am not a crystal ball reader, but if I were a broadcast network, I'd feel pretty good about being around in 5 years. And here's why. Broadcast depends on advertisers. Advertisers, like I said, need this space. They want this national reach. Even if the audience shrinks, I think those national broadcasters will still be there. The other question he had is about cable television networks. And there, I think, unless you're a top-tier cable network, be worried. I mean, as bundles get smaller, as more of us are looking for other ways to watch television, if you're not producing content that is buzzier that people want to watch and they have the choice of skinnier bundles, they're not going to choose you. And I think some of those cable channels might be in trouble over the next 5 years.
Let ESPN be your guide.
Yeah, right.
I think that's pretty interesting. So I've been to the Upfronts one time because I presented at the New Fronts two times. So the digital ad industry, in an attempt to counter all of this glitz and glitter, has its own Upfront-like week that they call the New Fronts, which, because they're
right,
new.
Right, right.
And then they go and they do media. Anyway, yeah, I went to the CBS one time, and it is indeed, speaking of shock and awe, you know, they get Juliana Margulies up there to give the initial presentation, and then they preview all the shows one after the other. You get these long previews. It's like being at the movie and waiting for the movie to start, except that that's all it is. And then they have this big party where all the stars are. And it's, I mean, I would imagine, I think if you're an advertiser, you're basically just like, awesome. You know, it's kind of who has the more stars. Anyway, I got to meet LL Cool J there, and I told him I was family because I worked for CBS Interactive, and he gave me the greatest bear hug of my life. Like, he's just a hugger. And sometimes when I need just a mental pick-me-up, I just imagine that hug, and I feel in a happy place. That's my story.
Next, I got nothing on that one. Next up, Annabelle Gurwitch tells us what life as a working actor is like, a continent, millions and millions of miles, an ocean away from this week's fancy TV glitter parties. But first, just like the television networks, we got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread.
Beans and cornbread.
So glad you tuned in to Dinner and a Movie tonight, because we're watching the creepy hand that rocks the cradle.
If this all sounds familiar, then you were watching cable TV in the 90s. I mean, I have like a visceral response to that. Specifically, the show on TBS called Dinner and a Movie. It launched in 1995. There are still versions. FX is still trying to do some version of that now where they play a movie 1 million times, but have some cute people tell you all about it. One of those people was our next guest.
Her name is Annabelle Gurwitch, and hosting Dinner and Movie was just one of many, 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 many television and movie gigs that she had. Believe me when I tell you her IMDb page goes for a while. These days, she's made a career change, actually. Mm-hmm. She writes books. She's got a new one out this month. It's called Wherever You Go, There They Are. And we got her in the studio a little while ago to tell us, glitz and glamour aside, what it's like to be a working actor.
We had this really long conversation with her in the studio, and because there are so many fascinating things in her book, like she talks about the loneliness of the gig economy. She has this whole section about multi-level marketing, which I want her to make into its own book. And she contends that these are all schemes targeted at women and that they're ruining a bunch of her friendships. So we talked about all of this great stuff, but in the interest of focus, we're going to pick it up right here with how she got into the business of show.
Can we back up for a minute and sort of set the scene here? You have survived in what is fundamentally a gig economy, that is entertainment and showbiz writ large, for low these many years.
Crazy.
How did you do it?
Just because you
go to your IMDb page and it goes on and
it
on.
It goes on and on, yeah.
On and on.
Well, this has to do with get rich quick scheme. So when I was
how's it working out so far?
Acting is a get rich quick scheme.
What happened was when I was in college at NYU studying acting, which is a fabulous career to go into when you come from a financially unstable family, my dad
one of his many bankruptcies. I got a call saying there was no money. So I have to drop out of college. I'm on my own. I started working as an actress at 19.
Wow.
So I go into acting.
By any measure, then you become what most people would consider, based on the IMDb page alone, a spectacularly successful actress. Actor.
Listen, I just think it's amazing if I get up every day and I'm dressed. And
right.
I'm wearing matching shoes. But let me just say, I take issue with what you said, Kai, because I don't work in the gig economy. In my understanding.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
I guess that's fair.
I'm a freelancer.
Right.
And
okay.
this is
right.
why
right.
I think it's a really important distinction.
Well, okay.
I'll tell you why.
Right.
Well, I'm telling you why.
No,
it's ridiculous.
Tell him why.
But this is why.
You can tell him anything.
And this has to do with the story in the book, which is that, I mean, not that it's better. As a freelancer, you know, you are typically working in a field that you are trained for, that you have experience in. In my understanding of the gig economy, which is why it's even one more layer of more frightening, more unstable, less to hold on to, is that you're just picking up work in anything that you can find. And that, to me, is what is really scary about the reliance and the growth of the gig economy, and why people who I'm writing about, why I got so emotionally invested in following the stories of these women who started working in multi-level marketing, which is not, they're not business women.
Right.
They're not trained for this. Mm. So this is a very thin layer. If this is what we're headed towards, that's really scary on a financial level.
You become an actress at 19.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to be hustling at 19 to get by, and it's another thing to be hustling at 50 to get by.
Mm-hmm. 55.
Okay, 55.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Can you still do it? I mean, does it get tiring? You're aging out of it, as you said? I mean,
yeah. I like to say, I went from one dying industry to another dying industry, publishing. It's just because I'm living on the edge. You know, a few years ago, writing took over my life. This is my fourth book now. I've been so lucky that I was able to turn a certain amount of notoriety as a performer. I had this popular show, Dinner in a Movie, with on TBS for many years. So that garnered me a certain kind of following. People, thank goodness, have stuck with me. And just in all the years of my work, I have to go Yiddish on this one. I finagled into a writing career with a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah. Like, walk us through how hard it is to be a working actor and what appears to be so glamorous from the outside. And then you look at it and you go, I don't think this is going to work long term.
I was really fortunate. I worked in theater. Then I started working on a soap opera. Then I started working in nighttime television. I got really lucky. Funny that my big sort of break was this TV show, Not Necessarily the News on HBO, which is new satire. And, of course, that was back in the years when I would say to people, I got a show. It's on HBO. But, you know, I got into this comedy family, which has been very loyal to me. My friends like Bill Maher, been really supportive over the years. And you go along these careers with them. And I made a really good living for many years. I was really lucky. And that allowed me to have the cushion to go into writing.
Could somebody 19 years old today do what you've done?
Oh, God, absolutely not. I hit a point where I wasn't a big enough star to continue to really make a good living, because all of a sudden there were so many markets. I mean, that's the thing that I think is really hard for people to, on the outside, look at. Well, there's so many shows.
Yeah, there's so much up, right? I mean, television's the place to be now, and you got, you know, where it peaked.
It's so hard to get a job that pays you enough money to make a living.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that's kind of hard to imagine. Like, in the future, you could have your really big star, like, say,
George Clooney,
who was my neighbor when we both started out together. We were neighbors. So you could picture a day. It's not hard if you work in the entertainment industry where the person who's like playing the supporting role, like selling him his coffee in a scene in a movie, is going to be actually a real barista. because you can't be an actor and play these roles anymore.
Wow.
I used to get a good living.
Meta.
Yeah,
that's
for
intense.
Doing a small role, and you can't do that
now,
anymore.
Why is that? What has changed that causes you to not be able to? Like, has the pay scale changed, or is it just the sheer
mass? It's the way that talent is valued in every business now. All the money is going to the top. I mean, I'm not saying anything new. And then you've got the middle has just dropped out. And anyone who's starting, you could get a job, but you can't make a living.
Can we talk life cycles here for a second?
Yeah, sure.
Of your originally chosen field of show business, are there moments of hope? I mean, do you look at like pilot season and say, oh, I could get onto a thing here? Or do you look at, I don't know, the September and the start of the fall season or whatever?
Or Netflix.
Where
I was really in
it,
I did. And I mean, I was really in it for many years. I'm just really, I've taken myself out of it.
Okay, so here's the follow-up.
Yes.
Do you miss it?
This is the thing. I do miss it.
Uh-huh,
and the reason I miss it is this family environment,
the tribe.
Because what I didn't think about going from being an actor to a writer is how that would affect my life emotionally and just the construct of my life. I didn't think to myself, I'm going to spend my days now alone in a room.
Because your chosen field is a solitary pursuit as opposed to an ensemble-like thing where you go to work every day with a bunch of people.
Right. So now I have like the opposite life than I used to have. People say, oh, it's so close. No, it's the opposite.
Right.
When I was acting, I'd want to come home, rest, be alone. Now I need people. Yep. So I do try to do a play a year. I have a sort of a way of mitigating this.
It's a maintenance dose.
It's a maintenance dose of work family. And then I do a shared office now, which has been a co-working situation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I love it. It has taken all these adjustments in ways I never anticipated.
Totally.
Never.
I love it. Annabelle Gurwitch, you're the best. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Clearly, we had a really fun time talking to Annabelle. It's important to say at this point that we were in the same room in the LA studio for that. And she's just really funny and energetic and all over the place. And so if you hear us having like just a really good time and being a little scattered.
Yeah. It was a dynamic interview. Let's call it dynamic.
Dynamic.
Annabelle Gurwitch, your book is called Wherever You Go, There They Are, Stories About My Family You Might Relate To, out now wherever you get your books.
And you can read a great excerpt, actually, from Annabelle Gurwitch's book, which includes a lot of the stuff we didn't talk about in this interview. That's at marketplace.org/makemesmart. And if you just, Kai's not going to like this, but if you just do a little DuckDuckGo search real quick for a recent essay that she may have written about book interviews, you will discover that Kai is on her laminated list.
No.
We'll be right back with your emails.
It's embarrassing. Whatever that was, I like that. I like that a lot. We are back now, and it is time to hear from you.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
All right. There were a lot of thoughts about our interview with Mayor Rahm Emanuel, like a lot, which we really appreciate because it was, much like the man himself, elicited a wide range of responses, and none of them were tepid. Here are just a few.
The interview with Rahm was interesting, to say the least. I was surprised, mostly in how authentic he seemed, as most public figures struggle with that despite their best intentions. Regardless of what you think of his views, though, as you noted, he was most certainly sincere and living with great conviction.
I loved this interview. There will likely be some listeners who wonder why more questions weren't asked about the mayor's responses to police incidents in Chicago, although I think it would have been great to have more questions about those. I understand that time was limited and there were a lot of topics to cover. But even with limited time, Molly and Kai managed to ask probing questions while providing the mayor plenty of time to answer. In fact, what I appreciate most about this interview is that very allowance of time, the silence while the mayor thinks. If this weren't a podcast, those silences might have to be trimmed. But here we get a politician giving real consideration to good questions, then giving passionate responses, many of which include something all too rare in politicians' answers, details.
It made me very angry that he did not really answer your question about the Chicago violence. I just spent some time in Chicago, and I was in the beautiful Gold Coast neighborhood. And on my way home, I really forced myself to get online and look up some things about the violence in Chicago, because I just felt like I was in just this gorgeous bubble within the city. So I really think this is what people mean when they say that politicians are not speaking to them, and they do not like this career politician stance. So I wondered how you felt about the way he answered that question as well.
You know, when a politician doesn't answer questions and you poke him in the eye and then he doesn't answer again, you know, it just it doesn't go anywhere. Right. So that's what happens with that question.
The problems with Chicago are many and have been well detailed.
Yeah.
And the answer to systemic violence, and I can say this as somebody who lives in Oakland, is not easy. And it takes a long time to turn those ships. In fact, we, for example, in Oakland, are just now starting to reap the benefits of economic recovery plans that Jerry Brown put into place when he was the mayor. Like, it just is speaking of the long game.
Jay O'Connor, Jeremy Campbell, and Jasmine Robinson sent us their thoughts, their voice memos. Everybody else sent us a bunch as well. Thank you for the thoughtful emails, because whatever you think of Mayor Emanuel and how he didn't or did answer the questions, he's clearly a thoughtful guy.
Yeah.
And that's all you can hope for.
I think it's funny. It's one of the most interesting interviews I have ever been a part of, I can tell you that. And people really did have strong reactions. I just saw a tweet from a woman saying that she was actually tearing up listening to it, because it's true that you rarely get that kind of intensity from politicians or CEOs. We got a lot of other email on a lot of other topics. Jeffrey B. wrote in about our book club, and this is an outstanding tip. He said, to any other listeners who are also fans of not lugging around 500-page books, while sadly not available in the Amazon Prime Lending Library, our book group's pick, The Righteous Mind, is available on Kindle through my local libraries. It was available on Kindle through his, at least, local library subscription to Overdrive. So he said, check out your library's digital collections. You can read a book for free and still not talk to an actual person. The library thing is something I really need to get better at, because that is true.
Oh, it's totally true. Some fun posts on the site this week. Tony Wagner, who is our faithful blogger and poster. I was about to call him a scribe, but actually he's much more than that. He has a post up, and I'm going to read you the title, and I'm going to say this word, even though I'm not sure it's allowed to be said in polite company, no matter what Tony's post says. The title is, What We Talk About When We Talk About Jagoffs.
You have to totally read it. Like, this post has it all. It has the whole regional etymology of the word and how it does not mean what you think it means, and how, like, Pittsburgh people use it and Mark Cuban. It's great.
Look, so one day I said on the radio, this was a number of years ago, I said, well, that guy was all boogered up because whatever, whatever, whatever. And I got a phone call from my mom when I got off the air saying, Kai, you can't say that on the radio.
Oh, bless.
And I was like, well, Mom, technically you can. So I'm trying to be aware, by God.
You know, we got one really good email. I didn't pull it up, but I committed it to memory because it was so good. And it said that your reluctance and refusal to use that word initially showed that you were an officer and a gentleman. And that was outstanding. And that my apparent over-willingness just meant that I'm indeed an uncoachable cowgirl.
There you go. So, is that what it said, or was that you?
I don't think it said cowgirl. It said uncoachable, though, which is kind of a longstanding issue in my life. Apparently, many of you have questions about the music on this show. We talk about it all the time. We wrote a post answering at least some of your musical questions. My son's fourth grade teacher asked me the other day, who gets to pick the music for Marketplace, Kai? I know you get a lot of those tweets.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like,
It's not me. Let's just be on the record here. It's not me.
Yep. Both of those posts can be found at marketplace.org/makemesmart. And thanks to Tony again, who keeps picking out these fun issues.
He does.
And then digging into them, sometimes really serious ones. And it's really, it's great. And a lot of you are reading those posts, and we are grateful.
Yeah, he's killing it. Don't forget to review us on Apple Podcasts, by the way, which I don't understand why they changed from iTunes, but whatever. Share the episode you like on your Facebook, your Twitter feeds. Write to us. Let us know what's on your mind. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. Also, subscribe, because that's the way the iTunes, Apple Podcasts algorithm works. I'm just saying.
We'll be back next week, everyone. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bodner, Cerise Castle, and senior producer Nancy Fergali. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday, and our theme music, including this rockin' tune right here, is composed in the house by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
Now, I like it a lot. I don't think I would say that it's rocking, though. I mean, it's good. I don't think it's rocking.
It's bopping.
Oh, look, and Ben, Ben's looking at me through the glass going, Kai, what?
Yeah, you want to watch it, dude. He's right there.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Star Nieves. Senior Vice President and General Manager is Deborah Clark. Write us. Let us know if you think it's rocking. Ooh, here comes a little rocking part.
See? You're dancing. I'm dancing.
I'm not dancing. I don't dance.
Write to us and tell us if you think Kai should dance more.
There will be no dancing. You can write till the cows come home. I'm not dancing.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.